Well, here's a household name that probably 5 years ago many people would not have recognized, Osama bin Laden, right? We're told that Osama bin Laden is a radical Muslim. We're told that he is perhaps an Islamo-fascist. We're told that he is one of the true believers. And his organization, Al-Qaeda, of course, seems to follow very closely in his footsteps. Is there a peculiar theology, Islamic theology, at work in Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda? We're going to be answering that question here for the next half hour of Issues, Etc. We'll talk about the origin of Osama bin Laden's worldview with Charles Stromer. You can join our conversation for the next half hour, for the next 2 hours of the program, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. Feel free to use it. We'll get your questions and comments right here in the studio. Issues ETC at KFUO.org. And then coming up in a half hour, we'll start audio open lines, and we'll end today's program with a sermon review. Charles Stromer is a visiting research fellow for the Center for Public Justice, where he is developing the Wisdom Project. He's author of the cover story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Submit or Die, the Geostrategic Jihad of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Charles Stromer, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be here, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Most people simply assume that if you know Osama bin Laden is a radical Muslim, if perhaps you know he's a Wahhabiist, you know everything you need to know about how his worldview has come to be what it is. Is there more to it than that?
Well, sure. And I think the first thing I'd like to say is that it's important to begin by placing what bin Laden and Al-Qaeda are doing in the broader context of the Middle East and in particular U.S. foreign policy in the region, because since the late 19th, early 20th century, the Muslim world has been shifting from Arab nationalism to being organized around the religion of Islam, you know, if I could put it this way, as a way to make their people and their cultures more prosperous and have a better life. And that cultural and social turn to religion has led to various ways of understanding Islam, not unlike, you know, it has done in Christianity. And so today in Islam itself, there are, believe it or not, liberal and moderate views, there's conservative views, there's fundamentalist views, and then there's these militant views of the religion. So, of course, it's the militants that are getting all the press, but I'm pointing it out to, you know, to mention to everyone that it's very easy to reduce Islam to sort of this monolithic understanding that it's all about terrorism, and that's just not the case, which is why the two-part article has gone in the journal, because there's much more to talk about besides just the militancy. But getting back to that, the militancy is a big part of what's going on today within sort of what people call these strains of Islam. And bin Laden, in particular, gets his militancy from a particular guy named Sayyid Qutb, who is an Egyptian intellectual who was martyred in 1966 in Egypt. And he was a man who was in prison for a long time, who was very much radicalized through his life in Egypt and the experiences that he had in the United States when he was over here in the late 1940s for 2 or 3 years. And he just became very radicalized and was looking at this sort of nationalism that had been in Egypt and thinking, this isn't helping us to prosper, to get where we want to go. And so maybe the religion of Islam is where we should really focus. And so he began to organize this whole worldview around this very strict and radical view of Islam that he came up with. And that's his writings, and that is one of the sources that bin Laden has developed his theological views from.
I guess it should also be said that Islam in general, I mean, as much as we can generalize about Islam, is in all of its forms perhaps not simply a religion, but a worldview, kind of the organizing principle. You even have a quote in your article, a blueprint for a just society. That's how it's understood by devout Muslims.
Yeah, and that's what, and again, there's liberal and moderate and extremist points of view in Islam to look at this, but Sayyid Qutb, who's sometimes been called the father of Islamic fundamentalism, he he had a particular way of looking at justice. In fact, in part two of the article, which is, I guess, going to come out in the next issue, I talk about that. He wrote a book called Social Justice in Islam, and in it is a quite detailed and rather impressive, I might add, a view of how he saw his radical sort of narrow views of Islam working itself out socially. And he covers a lot of particular ground there in areas that, for instance, law in America would cover, like issues of divorce and, you know, theft and all these various particular kinds of issues that the area of a law covers. You know, Sayyid Qutb had worked out this whole view of justice in Islam, and it's fascinating to read, and because it's very, he goes into areas that, you know, American jurisprudence wouldn't touch. Like, you know, he even wants to legislate about, you know, how people relate to one another socially and these sorts of areas that we wouldn't do here in the Western world. But so it's not like, you know, it's an irrationalism or a, you know, somebody just being sort of led emotionally to do strange things. It's some of the intellectuals behind this movement, like Qutb, have really worked out a worldview in which it's not just theoretical, but very practical.
Before we get into the particulars of Sayyid Qutb's worldview and how it influences Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in our modern context, then tell us first how Osama bin Laden came under the sway of Qutb's teachings.
Well, he was, bin Laden, that is, he was not directly under Qutb's teaching, but his brother was under Muhammad, was under, I'm sorry, Sayyid Qutb's brother Muhammad had been sort of exiled from Egypt to Saudi Arabia, and Muhammad Qutb was taken up by the Wahhabi community there and embraced with open arms and became a teacher in a university there where Osama bin Laden happened to be going to school. And he had was directly taught by Sayyid Qutb's brother, Muhammad Qutb, for many years in Saudi Arabia. So the influence began that way, and also after Qutb's martyrdom, so-called, in 1966 in Egypt, his writings, which he had spent over 10, 15 years in prison writing, he wrote voluminously. He wrote a many-volumed scholarly work on the Quran. He wrote Social Justice in Islam, Milestones, and several other smaller books in prison. After his martyrdom, his writings took off and really became, in the late 60s and early 70s, extremely popular in the Middle East. And Osama bin Laden and all of his sort of peers at the time would have had access to those as well. So it gave him a sort of a way of understanding Islam that fit his dissatisfactions and his the way he viewed the West and what he would consider the Western values were contaminating the Muslim world, and the American presence in Saudi Arabia had to go, and these sorts of things. Qutbism, as I call it, began to give him a way of radicalizing his worldview and his thinking from Sayyid Qutb's writings and also from Sayyid Qutb's brother Muhammad.
What were Sayyid Qutb's views on America and on Christianity?
Well, I found this fascinating in the research. He Sayyid Qutb, before he was sort of radicalized, he was a kind of a man of letters in Egypt in the 30s and 40s, and he was an educationalist, and he worked for the school systems there and was an inspector of schools and did a little teaching, and he ended up coming to the United States in the late 40s, right about the time, interestingly, that Israel was becoming a nation in 1948. And when he arrived in America, he really was in two minds about what he was going to experience here, and he had had evidently some kind of religious experience on the ship coming over, which sort of, I guess he would say before that he was a kind of a nominative a Muslim. He was, you know, not extremely religious. He would consider himself a Muslim, but he didn't pray five times a day at the time or any of the things that are fundamental to what we know about Islam. Coming over on the ship, he had some kind of conversion experience where he became a full-fledged believer, and so he brought that off the ship into the shores of America, and as he was traveling around doing education research and visiting around, he seemed to me fairly open-minded. He was a man who visited Christian churches and Christian schools and talked to people. And he had one experience that I report in the article is that he was in Colorado and had an experience where he went to a church service in the morning, and then in the evening he went to a social function, which was a dance. And he was just livid about what he saw there, what he considered the immorality. Now, remember, this was in the late 1940s, what he saw was, you know, young people dancing and holding each other close to each other and, you know, sort of getting, you know, their hips pivoting and, you know, sort of, you know, people kissing each other kind of a little bit and holding hands. And, you know, these are unmarried young people at this Christian social function, you know. And so that was one of many experiences that he had, which kind of, you know, we Christians would say, you know, well, you know, Jesus is, you know, not Lord of those people's lives, and in that area they shouldn't be that, you know, doing those kinds of things, you know. And for Khattab, he was saying, well, this doesn't fit the worldview of Islam. Islam has moral guidelines, so maybe, you know, Christianity in America is kind of pietistic. Maybe it's kind of split off the secular and the sacred realms. I think this is actually language that he used in his translations. He was quite ahead of his time in thinking about these splits that we would talk about in Christian philosophy today. And so he was sort of puzzled by all this, and he had several of these experiences, and he came to the conclusion at the end of his trip to America, not just from that, but from the way that the news reported on how Israel became a state and certain other events in the Middle East that had happened that were reported in the news media in America. He didn't like the way that was reported. He thought it was biased and prejudiced and very simplistic. And so all these experiences added up to him to make him very disillusioned with Americanism and also with Christianity.
So is it safe to say that at his first serious consideration of American society and Christianity in that light, he found Christianity as a religion and a worldview to be morally impotent?
It seems to be what he would say and what he would conclude, because he writes very strongly in some of his books about the fact that he has some sympathy with American Christianity and Western Christianity in some of its leaders who are seeing some of the same problems that he would discern in this area that you've just called the moral impotence. So he agrees with some of that assessment, even within Christianity. But his objection is that, and here's where he diverges radically from Christianity, he doesn't believe that Christianity has a solution to that. So he was quite at a loss as to how to give Christianity any kind of sort of, you know, pat on the back and say, okay, you've got good analysis and a good solution. He would say, well, I like some of your analysis, those of you that are analyzing this like I am and seeing some of the problems, but he would just get off the ship at that point and say, you know, I don't think Christianity is the way ahead here, it's Islam.
We're talking about the origins of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda's worldview in the thoughts and writings of Saeed Khattab. Charles Stromer is our guest. He's a visiting research fellow for the Center for Public Justice, where he's developing the Wisdom Project, and he's written the cover story for the most recent Christian Research Journal titled Submit or Die, the Geostrategic Jihad of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in number 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In about 15 minutes, audio open lines. We'll listen to a new TV ad launched by the United Methodist Church, and then the trailer of a film that's coming out called Jesus Camp. That's coming up here in about 15 minutes. So talk about the political aspects or the critique. Was Saeed Khattab capable of distinguishing between Westernism, Americanism, and Christianity?
Well, he believed that, you know, it's hard to get inside somebody's mind and say exactly what they believe, but I believe he believed that, you know, Western society was a product of Christianity. So that, I mean, he was very, very well read, and he knew he could argue long distances down the road from points of view that he knew because of his studies in the 20s and 30s and 40s about Western philosophy and Western political leaders and Western Christian leaders, and his conclusions, some of them, many of them are in the book. In fact, he justifies a lot of his conclusions about his dislike for the West from the Quran. He would have concluded, Todd, that, you know, the Christianity gave rise to Western culture and lost the script, if you will, and because it lost its holistic emphasis and became a secular culture. So he would blame, he would make a distinction between Westernism and Christianity, but he would see Christianity as being the root problem of why Western culture is as it is today.
Then more broadly, as a worldview, as Khattab's worldview came into focus for him, every worldview has as one of its elements a hermeneutic for history. What was Sayyid Khattab's?
Well, he had a, what I call in the article, a fatal, came up with the concept of a fatal flaw of history. That's my language, not his, but I think it's evident that that's what he was on about. He believed that if you go back into history, into the Old Testament times, and look at the revelation that God gave to the Jews at Sinai, he believes, and he writes plainly about this in his books, that God gave the Jews this revelation at Sinai that was a holistic view. That is to say, it was not just for religious life, but it was for all of life. It was for educational life. It was for family life. It was for moral life. It was for juridical life, for aesthetic life, and so on. And this is language that he would use in his books, because he was also a kind of a philosophically oriented as well as being theologically oriented. And that makes his books, you know, kind of interesting to read, because he's wise enough to know the difference between the two disciplines and yet bring them together in a fascinating way that we Christians often miss. But moving on, he looked at that revelation, that holistic revelation that he believed God gave to the Jews, and said, okay, you got this, but you blew it. You went off after a few years and you developed this nation, and then you began to buy into the pagan ways of doing political life, the pagan ways of doing education, the pagan ways of doing, you know, social life, and you forgot that you had this holistic revelation from Sinai. And he saw that as history's fatal flaw. That is to say, he feels that's where history went wrong. And so that would be his sort of, you know, teleology, starting from there and moving on up into modern history. I think he would agree that if the Jews had kept the holistic approach from the Sinai revelation, he probably wouldn't have this chip on his shoulder about it. But he sees this fatal flaw where history went wrong. It diverged off from God's full revelation for all of life. And his view of Islam is to recover that full revelation for all of his life, for all of life. And that is why his books are filled with, like, these theories about social justice and how Islam is this whole life worldview, like we Christians would say, you know, if Jesus isn't Lord of all, he's not Lord at all. Well, Khattab would have his own view of that about Islam, and that he would say that Islam is for political life and religious life and social life and educational life. And, of course, we saw, you know, with the Talibanized Afghanistan before the U.S. Ousted the Taliban and al-Qaeda from power there, we saw a kind of contemporary example of how that kind of real rigid, extreme view would work itself out into culture.
Dave is on the line from St. Charles. Dave, thanks for being patient and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, glad to be able to ask a question here. I recently read your article, very excellent, Etc. in part one. I'm anxious for part two. But either in your article, since I think Osama bin Laden, Zarkal is mentioned in there, and Sataba had high influence on Osama bin Laden and his actions and his thoughts, and also CNN had a great, excellent 2-hour special on Osama bin Laden from little on up, but either one of those two, I got the situation that Osama bin Laden was criticized by other Islamists that he didn't warn first, that supposedly supposed to ask, like the recent television Americanized Taliban person said, convert to Islam or die. Well, apparently in Islam it's supposed to be more honorable to warn your enemies first and then do it. So is this a recent thing that's setting the table for more Islamist terrorism things by warning convert to Islam or die?
All right, Dave, thank you very much for the question. And Charles, can you give us just a minute or two on the other side of the break?
Sure.
Okay, let's get to Dave's question then. He talks about the most recent videotape that's come out of Al-Qaeda from one of the deputies of Osama bin Laden and the warning in English from an American convert to Islam that we ought to convert. And he mentions that, yes, Al-Qaeda was criticized by some Muslims for saying, look, you didn't warn anybody before you attacked them. Is this a bellwether of bad things to come?
Well, this is where I think there's a common misunderstanding. In the research I've been doing for the new book I'm writing on this broader topic that I mentioned at the top of the show, of looking at the whole picture, I've discovered that, Bin Laden did indeed warn the West, but this is not often talked about very much. In 1996, he went and had made some public statements about how mad he was at America and the West. But in 1998, he and a team of Islamic radicalists put together an official declaration of war against the United States, and in that declaration, which is short and terse and to the point, he lists in there the things that the U.S. must do if it wants to avoid this war that's coming from him. And so I would encourage anyone who's interested in this to go online and read that declaration. I don't know the exact title of it, but it was in 1998, and it's easily found on the Internet. It's short. It's just a few pages long, and in that, it's quite plain that he has indeed given a lot of warnings. And then we have the warnings of the attacks that he did before 9/11 and the ones that have gone on since. None of that's to say that, in fact, in part two of the article, I'm going to deal with the very issue of forced conversions, because it's kind of a misnomer in some ways, in some ways it isn't, but that is a part of the issue, and I don't really know at this point where it's going to lead.
Before we go to this break, would you say it's fair to say that to rightly understand Osama bin Laden and his worldview, which I want you to put in a nutshell on the other side of the break, is it fair to say that he is a Khattabist, in addition to the other things that he is, and that you really can't get Osama bin Laden and what he's been up to unless you understand his roots with Saeed Khattab?
Well, I think that's right, because it's not enough to understand that he's a Wahhabist in the sense that the Wahhabi educational system in Saudi Arabia is. In order to really understand that, you've got to think of how influential the American public school system is here and how widespread the Wahhabi system in Saudi Arabia, to be brief about it, is the educational system throughout Saudi Arabia, and it's very extreme fundamentalist. He was raised in that. It's very hard to actually document exactly what they're taught, and we have sound bites and a few little works on this, but there is a lot of information now from Saeed Khattab himself, and we know that he was very steeped in that. So yes, you're right to say that Khattab is a major clue for understanding what makes bin Laden tick.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to get a few more questions for Charles Stromer on the origin of Osama bin Laden's worldview. Stay tuned. Then we'll have audio open lines.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Pastor Mark Schaefer, Coordinator of Continuing Education and Related Events at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of equipping the priesthood of all believers.
It's so important that, the church, we have faithful pastors, but we also have faithful laypersons. The church can't exist without people. And the more that our lay people understand their role and how they fit in the church, I think it's good for the church's mission. It's good for the church's service. It's good for the worship life of the church, too.
To find out about the fall retreats at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, including a lay leadership retreat and a Christian Vision for Love and Marriage conference, check out their website, ctsfw.edu, or call them, area code 260-452-2204. Equipping the priesthood of all believers, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Attempts to stop Internet gambling aren't dead yet in the Senate. Majority Leader Bill Frist says he has a plan to bring to the floor a bill to prohibit most forms of Internet gambling. It passed unanimously in the House, but will it be voted on this session in the Senate? Jessica Stallings has the story.
With a click of a mouse, you can access a virtual casino in your living room. But before you log on, David Robertson with the National Coalition Against Legalized Gambling wants to deal you some advice.
Internet gambling needs to be recognized as the most addictive form of gambling ever invented. 65% of those who gamble on the Internet become addicted.
Right now, Internet gambling is illegal in the U.S., but the Department of Justice is hesitant to confront the issue because the language is too gray. Focus on the Family Action gambling analyst Chad Hills says that's why passage of the Internet Gambling Bill, H.R. 4411, is so important.
This bill would clarify that language. It would prohibit illegal offshore Internet gambling, and it would give the DOJ the teeth that they need to prosecute illegal Internet gambling.
The bill passed in the House by a tremendous majority, and the Senate is expected to do the same if given the opportunity.
Contact the Senate Majority Leader and urge him to bring this issue to the floor. He has already said in his speech to the president that he intends to do so, but he needs encouragement to keep this on the autumn agenda.
If the bill makes it to the Senate floor and passes, President Bush has promised to sign it into law. For Family News in Focus, I'm Jessica Stallings.
The legislation clarifies the Federal Wire Act that banned interstate telephone gambling and included wireless communication. It is estimated that the U.S. spends $6 billion a year on illegal Internet gambling. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Do you want more of God's grace? Village Lutheran Church in Ladue is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Village Lutheran Church is located at 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue, www.villagelutheranchurch.org. Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, 314-993-1834.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is actually a CD and a booklet. It's titled Listening to Luther. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The CD contains a recording of Luther's Small Catechism and hymns by Martin Luther. The booklet contains a history of the Small Catechism and several of Martin Luther's hymns, including the text. Listening to Luther, our Issues Etc. book of the month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. A few more minutes here with Charles Stromer, author of the cover story of the latest Christian Research Journal titled Submit or Die, the Geostrategic Jihad of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. We're talking about the influence of the thought and writings of Saeed Qutb on Osama bin Laden, other Muslims, and Al-Qaeda in particular. So let's two final questions here. If you could, understanding Osama bin Laden as a Qutbist as well as all the other things that he is, could you put his worldview into a nutshell for us? How does Osama bin Laden view the world, Islam, and its relationship to everyone else?
Well, I have, for better or for worse, I'll let the listeners judge. And I think I would just want to say quickly also that it's important to keep in mind, for us to keep in mind, that there is this bigger picture and of different kinds of Islam, and not to pigeonhole the entire religion in what I'm about to say here. I've summarized it with the shorthand, submit or die. I believe that it's a totalitarian ideology that wants to put a gun to your head and say, submit to Islamic law or you're going to die. So I call it the submit or die ideology. It's developed fully in some of Saeed Qutb's more militant writings, especially in a short book that he's got called Milestones, which is kind of a summary of a lot of his teaching. It's very militant in tone. And in that, he talks about, implementing a Muslim vanguard, the word that he uses for it, to sort of purify itself through the Quran, and then studying the Quran and the religious ceremonies, et cetera, and so on. And then once they're purified, then they can go out and fight for Islam to implement this Islamic totalitarian view in the cultures where they're in, and then it will sort of like emerge from there into the nations and et cetera and so on. And I don't see any negotiating with that particular point of view, which is why I put at the top of the show this whole discussion in the broader context of U.S. relations in the region, because U.S. foreign policy specialists have to deal with the submit or die ideology. There's no negotiating with it. It can't be negotiated with. But you can have negotiations, and negotiations are going on with the more moderate governments and have gone on. I mean, after all, Israel has a peace treaty with Jordan and with Egypt. So it is possible. But the negotiations will go on with the moderates and the conservatives and even some Muslims call themselves liberals and progressives, and even some Muslims refer to themselves as secularists. Those are the dialogue partners for U.S. foreign policy. But when it comes to the submit and die ideologues, you know, it's either got to be police action or, unfortunately, probably military action.
Why are the more moderate or perhaps liberal Muslims, why are they not as vocal as they could be in speaking out against Islamicists like Osama bin Laden?
Well, it's a tricky one, that, because they are speaking out, but they don't get the press. In one sense, it's just a methodological problem. There's only so much space on an evening news broadcast or an article in a newspaper to put stories, and so things got to be left out. The moderates, or the reformers, as I call them in a different article in another magazine, they've been doing their thing behind the scenes for years and years and years, and they're just as upset about the events of 9/11 and Al Qaedaism as we are. In fact, shockingly, a Muslim scholar that I'm in dialogue with, who is a university professor here in the States, he wrote an article not long after 9/11. He's describes himself as a liberal Muslim, and he's writing a completely different methodological way than the fundamentalists or conservatives would. And he published an article that went into many, many papers around the world not long after 9/11. It was titled, Dear Mr. Bin Laden, Go to Hell. I mean, so these people, the liberal Muslims, are very strong in their beliefs opposing what Bin Laden is up to. It's just that they're not getting a lot of press, and they need to get a lot more press. And why, you know, American Christian organizations and others aren't speaking out more plainly and frequently and boldly is a question I have and would like to put to them at some time.
Are the more moderate and liberal Muslims speaking out on Arab TV or just occasionally to the Western media? I mean, it's one thing to speak out to the Western media. It's another thing to speak out to the media that is going to be filtered into the Islamic world.
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I think it's really, you know, up to who's speaking, what they want to say, the audience. You know, you're right, the audience that they're speaking to. It's very difficult for Americans and American Christians and Westerners in particular to sort of get their minds around this, and I don't think there's any really good way to understand, you know, as a general pattern what's going on. But so I think, you know, as I've been trying to do, like with Mukhtar Khan, the scholar I was just referring to, you know, get in dialogue with a guy like that and, you know, try to pick his brain and see what's going on and learn from him, and he learns from me. And I remember the first time I talked to him, you know, he said, "Oh, you published something called Openings." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, well, let me read to you the opening of the Quran," you know. So I let him read, you know, the verses there from the Quran to me, you know, and then I read him some stuff, you know, as well. So, you know, a dialogue began there. And so, you know, he's a guy that, you know, you can say, okay, he's doing what he can. He's got a massive website. He gets asked to speak all around the world. He's being very clear about what he's doing. And then, you know, maybe you have other Muslims who are maybe hedging their bets more and not wanting to, you know, be so clear in their lines of demarcation. And then you've got, of course, the radicals. So I think, you know, it's kind of a big hodgepodge.
Charles, you're directing the Wisdom Project for the Center for Public Justice. What is the Wisdom Project?
Well, it's a multi-year, multi-aspected initiative in this larger context that I've been mentioning that deals with U.S. international relations and foreign policy in the Middle East, and its centerpiece is a new book I'm writing on wise foreign relations. And then the also is the things are coming out of it, like the articles I've written for the CRI Journal on Saeed Kitab, and there'll be other articles and columns and policy papers in Washington and trips to Washington, and because the Center for Public Justice is in Washington and Annapolis. And so I'm working with them on this, and so that hopefully the project is going to, and has been a bit already, starting to influence some of the influencers from a biblical Christian point of view, using the wisdom tradition and trying to just make some noise there and say to people, you know, okay, idealism is one way of looking at foreign policy and realism is another way, and then there's subgroups within those bigger paradigms, but also there's this wisdom tradition in the scripture that's been neglected, which also has a lot to say about politics and international relations and foreign policies. And fascinatingly, Todd, the thing that lights my fuse is the wisdom tradition in the Old Testament used in the nation of Israel actually was set in the ancient Middle East. So today we're talking about the modern Middle East. So there may be some bridges that can be built there to help people with their understanding in a way ahead.
Charles Stromer is visiting research fellow for the Center for Public Justice. He's developing the Wisdom Project there. He's author of the cover story for the latest Christian research journal titled Submit or Die, the Geostrategic Jihad of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Charles, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for everyone who's called and for your support.
At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they're training a generation of pastors, the next generation of pastors, in fact, to be faithful Christian Lutheran pastors in a church that will face as pretty much part of the furniture of society, not only on the geopolitical side, but even locally, interaction with Islam, both the liberal form of Islam and the more radical form of Islam. Now, folks, a smiling evangelical like Joel Osteen is going to do the church no good against the onslaught of Islam, and pastors who are willing to kind of toy around with Islam and say, oh, come on, it's all the same God, they're not going to do us any good, they're only going to do us harm. At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they're training pastors to stand up for the truth of God's Word and the exclusive claims of Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life. For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, go to our website and find their logo, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Or you can call them toll-free, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155.
Find your path and share the journey. The people of the United Methodist Church.
That's just a little bit from some of the TV ads that have been playing nationally from the United Methodist Church. Find your path, share the journey. The theme of the new ag campaign is diversity. Now, yesterday we were talking about something, I forget what it was, but several of our callers mentioned that they had seen on television here in St. Louis these ads for the United Methodist Church, and one of them commented that what stuck in his mind was this phrase, if you really embrace diversity, you embrace God. And he was saddened to hear that, putting diversity over the truth. We're going to be playing that ad for you, get your reaction to it. And also something I listened to earlier this afternoon. Actually, I watched the trailer for this movie called Jesus Camp from Magnolia Pictures. It's going to be in theaters in the middle of September. And, you know, you see these movies like, I'm a big horror movie fan. So these movies like The Grudge or Saw 2. And my wife just puts her hands over her eyes and if she could, just run out of the room. When those trailers for those horror movies come on, they scare her. She doesn't like to see the scary images. What I saw in this Jesus Camp movie, I can deal with the crazed maniac with the chainsaw. What I saw there scared me more. And perhaps you'll agree, perhaps you'll disagree. We start audio open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Happy to take your questions and your comments on any subject during audio open lines. Either call us 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're coming to you live this Thursday, the 7th of September. Now let's hear the ad. This is one of them. It's a new TV ad launched by the United Methodist Church. The theme is diversity, and I want your reaction to it.
I believe no one who asks for help to be turned away.
I believe it's good to question.
None of us are qualified to judge the lives of others.
I believe a church is in a building.
When you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God.
I can't believe there's a church that believes these things.
We may not all believe exactly the same thing, but the people of the United Methodist Church believe in God and each other. If you're searching for something to believe in, our hearts, our minds, and our doors are always open.
It's an old theme with the United Methodist Church. They've had that our hearts, our minds, our doors are open for some time now. And now they've started a variation on that theme, emphasizing diversity. The tagline in there that is catching people's attention is, when you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God. And some of the things that were said there, this is a very well-produced commercial. I'm sorry for the state of the audio. We get it down off the internet and, you know, it just didn't sound that great. But you may have heard a couple phrases in there. One of them was, not only when you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God, but also a woman's voice saying, none of us are qualified. I don't think any of us are qualified to judge another's life. Now, this goes along with where the United Methodist Church has been headed for some time, along with some of its other fellow travelers in mainline liberal denominations like the UCC, where they're emphasizing the same thing. Look, all these other churches, they're not diverse. Not in the way people think, not in what they believe. We're diverse. Whatever it is you believe. In fact, they even say it in their commercial, we don't all believe the same thing. But at least we believe in God and one another. And that's how they're trying to sell the United Methodist Church. I want to hear from United Methodists in the audience today. Is this the kind of church that you signed on to when you became a Methodist so many years ago? Not just Methodists, of course. I want to hear from the rest of you as well. What do you think of the United Methodist commercials? We've played commercials from the UCC, and this is the latest. When you really embrace diversity, you embrace God. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Karen's up first. She calls from her car. Karen, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. I've got one that kind of puzzles and or scares me. I see it on the billboards, and I believe it's the United Methodist. It's got a picture of a dandelion puff, and it says, if you can wish, you can believe.
If you can,
and I've never quite figured that out, yeah.
If you can wish, you can believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, you're right there, Karen. When you drive by one of those and you see it, you're just left scratching your head saying, what is that? Is it a beer ad? Is it an ad for perfume? Is it an ad for a church? And if it is, what in the world does it mean? If you can wish, you can believe. I mean, at least Robert Schuller says, if you can dream it, you can do it. That makes more sense. That's kind of be all you can be. But that one's got me puzzled too, Karen.
No crosses, no nothing except, you know, the church there. You can see that it's a church under there. But
now, have you seen
a little puffball?
Have you seen the United Methodist ad on television?
No, I have not. I don't watch TV, so I never get to see those. I miss a lot of the world, thank goodness.
All right, thank you very much for the call, Karen. Luckily, she still listens to the radio. I guess she wouldn't be calling if she didn't listen to the radio. If you can wish, you can believe. That's you know, for some of these churches, like the United Methodist Church of the UCC, that's an appropriate symbol rather than a cross, which is kind of a prickly thing, and especially if you've got a dead man hanging on it, paying for the sins of the world. A more appropriate symbol might be the dandelion puff. What do they call those things? I know they call them dandelions, but that stands for the whole plant. What's the dandelion puff? I don't know. The thing that Horton hears a who picks up when he finds his who's. Maybe it's in a more appropriate symbol. I mean, churches are always looking for logos that communicate what it is they're really all about. And there's that dandelion puff. It's all fluffy and pretty, and you blow on it, and it just kind of goes away. And you have more dandelions, which, from where I come from, dandelions are not good things. With the temperature dropping, I've noticed a few of those yellow flowers in my yard. And you know what I do to dandelions? I spray them until they're dead. I don't know, last time I checked, they were weeds. I guess you can eat them, too. Okay, I want you to listen closely. The audio is not as good as it could be, but listen closely again to the United Methodist ad. It's called the Diversity ad. That's just its official title. It's running all over the country. And I want you to listen for everything that's said there, including that tagline, when you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God.
I believe no one who asks for help to be turned away?
I believe it's good to question.
None of us are qualified to judge the lives of others.
I believe a church isn't a building.
When you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God.
I can't believe there's a church that believes these things.
We may not all believe exactly the same thing, but the people of the United Methodist Church believe in God and each other. If you're searching for something to believe in, our hearts, our minds, and our doors are always open.
Okay, is that what you're looking for in a church? A church where they say, look, we don't all believe exactly the same thing, but we believe in God and we believe in each other. And we believe in diversity, whatever that means to you. I wonder how diverse the United Methodist Church really is willing to be. Would they put up with a guy like me? I mean, I'm part of the patchwork quilt that is diversity. Would they put up with someone like you? Would they? Does diversity include someone who takes the Bible seriously? Who does believe a lot of things besides in God and in other people? Is the umbrella big enough for someone like you or me to stand under it? What's your reaction to the United Methodist television ads? When you truly embrace diversity, you embrace God. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Audio Open Lines. We're coming to you live this Thursday, September the 7th. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. If you're a Methodist listening, what do you think about your church's way of portraying itself in the public eye? Ultimate open doors, minds, and hearts. I mean, how open does the mind, how open can a mind be before what you believe as a Christian no longer matters? What do you make of a church that says, we don't all believe exactly the same thing, but we believe in God and each other? And that, at least according to the United Methodist Church, is about all the more you can expect from a church. Believe in God, whoever that may be, and each other. What if you believe you're God? What if I believe I'm God? Do you still believe in me? You know, you could kill two birds with one stone. If you believe I'm God, then since you believe in God and you believe in, and we believe in each other, you don't have to believe in a God outside yourself. Just believe in the one that, in me. Is that a viewpoint that would fall under the diversity, fall outside the diversity of the United Methodist Church? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Eric in Olathe, Kansas writes this. I saw the commercial in KC the other night. The phrase that caught my attention was, we may not all believe the same thing. I think the phrase is, we may not all believe exactly the same thing. Is it wrong to believe exactly the same thing? Is that the problem here? Christians who believe exactly the same, it's okay to believe kind of the same thing, but not exactly the same thing? Eric says, I remember finishing it for my wife, quote, we may not all believe exactly the same thing, but we're united, darn it. Deeds, not creeds, says Eric. Yeah, that's exactly what this is. This is deeds, not creeds, taken to its logical extreme. We don't all believe exactly the same thing. In fact, we may not all believe anything at all in common except in God and each other. I'll tell you what, it's ready-made for America, though. It is ready-made for America. Because if there's one thing Americans believe in, it's God and each other. Andy calls from Kirkwood. Hi, Andy.
Well, I hate to throw a monkey wrench into their works, but how do they define diversity? You know, could they run into an argument over that?
Oh, golly, don't ask those kind of questions. You're not supposed to think it that far through, Andy. I love Andy. He's always got it right down to like 15 words. He must be like a newspaper editor or something. Thank you very much for the call. Right. Can you disagree? Are you allowed to disagree over the definition of diversity? If diversity is the watchword of the church today, actually, the only creed that really operates in churches like this, as far as I'm concerned, is unity in diversity. I remember one time criticizing that on the air, and someone wrote me via the email, and they said, look, unity and I said it was nonsense. Unity and diversity is rationally nonsense. And someone wrote me and said, it's not nonsense. And I said, well, if you're talking about matters that don't really matter, like what? The makeup of human society. Of course, you're going to have unity and diversity. We've got it on our money, don't we? E pluribus unum, which is basically unity and diversity. When you're talking about things that don't really matter, like getting along in society with one another, non-theological issues, yes, I guess you could have unity and diversity. Although one might wonder how well it's worked out for us as a nation. One begins to wonder at some point, is there anything holding us together at all? When you're talking in matters of the church, and Jesus says, and prays to his Father that they may all be one, is he talking about that minimalistic view of unity, which is, hey, we all believe in God and we believe in one another? Were those Jesus' parting words to his disciples there in Matthew 28? Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of whatever God, teaching them whatever you want. Nothing if you don't want to teach them anything. Teaching them to observe whatever it is they want to believe in. Teaching them to be diverse. Is this what Jesus said? Oh, by the way, guys, unity and diversity. See you later. No. I mean, what Jesus actually said is, I guess it would be called intolerant today in the church. You go make disciples, baptizing in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. That's not some generic God. It's a very peculiar and particular God, teaching them to observe everything I have commanded you. Not, we don't all believe exactly the same thing. And I don't think that was the disciples' boast when they began to preach Christ in the face of persecution. Hey, come on, we don't all believe exactly the same thing. We believe in God and in one another. It's Audio Open Lines. When we come back, we'll have a little bit more. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the theology of Harry Potter. Dr. Richard Stockwish will join us. It's a perspective, by the way, on the Harry Potter series of novels and films that you probably won't hear anywhere else on Christian radio. Then Sunday night on Issues Etc., day one of our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour from Chicago. We'll be discussing the church growth movement with Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine. That's live from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Monday on the program, we'll be doing day two of our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour in Chicago. We're going to be broadcasting live from Concordia University, Chicago. The subjects we'll be covering with Dr. John Johnson, born-again theology. We'll talk about how we got the Old Testament with Dr. Andrew Steinman. It'll be good to see him face-to-face again. And then we'll discuss free will, not free willy, free will, with a roundtable of Chicago area pastors. That's live Monday on Issues Etc. in day two of our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour in the Windy City. When we come back from this break, more audio open lines for your questions and your comments. We will be hearing a bit of this trailer from the movie called Jesus Camp. Scariest thing I've seen in a long time. I'll tell you why on the other side of this break. And then we'll do a sermon review of a sermon preached by Pastor Ed Young on building a marriage. Pastor Ed Young is host of the radio and television program called Winning Walk and pastor of Second Baptist Church in Houston, Texas. Stay tuned.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.